Park Place meeting, Thursday morning, 29th May 1975. In the state of communion, and especially in the state of the Supreme Communion, the silence speaks to us. It tells us the ultimate truth of our being. It is the state in which our true worth is realized. Because we are the selfless instruments of the Word of Truth itself, the Divine Word, if you like. And that realization of our worth completely annuls any question we may have in our minds of what use are we in this world. It is so easy to feel depressed in our worldly state. And the source of that depression is our egoistic self-consciousness. We want to be somebody. And our wanting to be somebody inevitably is at the expense of another body. It is at the expense of another body because in our petty little misperceptions of ourself, we are somebody by comparison with another. The moment comparison with another is introduced, there is the state of disunity, the state of unlove. But in communion, when we are truly selfless, then our supreme worth is realized. It is made real. It is not measured by us. In fact, we are quite unconscious of it. And it is in that unconscious, unself-conscious state that the supreme things happen. If and when we, especially people like ourselves, who are concerned with religious fulfillment and religious living, when we feel depressed and wonder whether we are any use to man or God or anybody, then recall this fact, that this one total reality, transcendence itself, brought us into being, sustains us, and uncomplainingly will take us back into its bosom when this little manifestation on earth, which is oneself, has run its course. So in our worldly state, when we feel depressed, just recall this, and we will see that it is absurd to ask such a question. What use are we? The whole universe takes the trouble to bring us into being and nurture us. You see, whenever any problem in life comes into being, the problem fundamentally is oneself. It is not the other person, it is not the situation or the accident or whatever it may be. The problem fundamentally is always myself. That is to say, myself in my self-conscious state, cutting myself adrift from the totality. Now, if I understand myself to start with, the understanding, the right understanding of the problem will always emerge easily. And then there is no problem. The problem is always the self. So now, this silence which speaks to us, it speaks without words, without thoughts, without concepts, without intermediary. It is an extraordinary speaking. If one ever gets a touch of this, he will know, although he will have hardly any power of conveying it to another, what this silence means and what it is like. Having said that, let us speak of the silence today. Our language, all our vocabularies, consisting of words, represent that which is limited, particular, finite, and therefore mortal. Whatsoever comes into being as an apparently separate object or person, there is a word for it. A chair, a table, a man, a lion, a mosquito, a tree, whatever it is. So we have our great collection of nouns, naming words, as we say. And then we have those other words which are of such great importance, the doing words, the verbs. I went to the town. I, the naming word, went, the verb, the doing word. Or John cooked a meal. Doing words, one doing word linking two naming words. But you see, all these are limited, finite. You can't speak of the absolute, of transcendence in that way. Now, all this comes within the sphere of mortality. Everything represented by a word in the vocabulary represents that which comes into being, proceeds or grows, and then finishes or dies. This is how we look at it. This is how we talk of it. Because this is how we are conscious of our existence in our worldly state. The worldly mode of consciousness is a restricted mode. It's a mode which is caught in the toils of mortality. Death and the grave are the ultimate end of everything limited and finite. Now, the discipline of the religia, whoever he may be, to whatever religion he may belong, the discipline of the yogi, the discipline of the mystic, the living of the religious life, is one which takes us out of this prison house of mortality. Out of this prison house of mortality in mind and consciousness. Obviously, we cannot get out of the state of mortality bodily. The body will necessarily come into being, subsist for a time, and then perish. But in mind and consciousness, we can realize, actually experience, a state of being which is the immortal. It doesn't arise, it doesn't proceed, it doesn't end. It is just there like that. What happens is that through the living of the religious life, the discipline of the mystic, the yogi, the religia, we awake out of this limited state into the unlimited state. This is the awakening to the whole reality. That is why you will find that all these disciplines, whether it is the Upanishadic or the Buddhist or the Zarathustrian or the Christian or the discipline of the yogi, whatever it is, if it is a true and a great discipline, is one which awakens us to this wholeness of reality, instead of keeps us confined to our consciousness of things as separate, as unrelated. Now we may inquire, what are some of the landmarks of this? We are conscious of separate things and persons through the activity of our senses in our daily life. We see, as we say, something, one thing. We hear some sound, touch something, and so on. Whatever we see, hear, and touch is limited and finite. And with the operation of the senses, our speech faculty talks all the time in accord with that which comes to us through our senses. I look out of the window and say, oh, there's an oak tree. The mind tells me this silently. But there is that state and condition which begins to supervene when the sense activities are pacified. Now note the word I have used there. Not when they are stopped repressively or deliberately. Not when you have, so to say, become unaware of the world, but when the sense functions are pacified, they are peaceful. The eyes may still see and consciousness may still register that which is going on. Your ears may hear the song of a bird, and so forth. But with the pacification of the senses, the brain ceases to talk back at the sense impression. This is the crucial point. When the brain ceases to talk back at any and every sense impression, then the unnecessary flow of talk, the silent flow of talk, which we call thinking, discursive thinking, becomes utterly restful, peaceful. It stops, in actual fact. The senses will register still. The brain will know that registration. But the brain, fully awake, is in a state of rest. That is the ending of the flow of discursive thought. That is the pacification of the senses. And there is no disturbance caused in our own mind and in consciousness by any sort of turmoil due to desire, fear, reaction, the uprising of any sort of whim or fancy or possessiveness, greed, or delusion. All this has become utterly pacified. It is as if it were a psychical ablution. You come out clean. You are in a clean state. And that is the first portal of death through which the religio goes through. This is the meaning of dying to the world. One does not die to the reality of the universe at all, because one is everlastingly in relationship with it. It is the garment of God, the whole world, and you are everlastingly in union with it unknowingly. But you die to your own worldliness. You die to the turmoil and the disturbance in your own psychical being. You die to your own impure state. Impure and therefore inadequate, incomplete, confused, disharmonious state. That is why when you are in true prayer, when you are in true contemplation, the climax of which is the contemplative union, when you are in that state, then there is peace, there is wholeness. And that is the first silence. The first grade of silence, if you like. The Buddhists speak of it as the entry into the second state of meditation, of dhyana, in Pali, jhana. Discursive thought has ceased. There is still the experiencing, because of the sensitivity of the psyche, there is still the experiencing of a condition of peaceful joy, very intense. It is not limp. It is very vital. There is still the experiencing of a certain transcendental sorrow. This is the sorrow that the soul experiences, that the mind experiences, because it is so awake to the sorrow and the suffering of the whole of the manifested universe, which is in travail, although it may demonstrate what appears to us as the ecstasy, the exuberance, the joy of life, and so forth. It is nevertheless in a state of travail. It is not in the state of its Sabbath, the state of rest, which is not static, which is not inactivity, but is the supreme activity. So, the mind is still aware of that. But it is already peaceful, quiet. And there comes the point when all that fades away and there is absolutely pure equanimity, the state of purified mindfulness, pure mindfulness. Now do remember that the whole process of silent talk has ceased, which means there are no thoughts, as we call them. There is no uprising of concepts, no flow of ideas in that state. All that has been written about these things in all the great religions of the world has been written through the action of the memory, of one's own memory, reconstructing this indescribable impress which is made upon the psyche, upon the mind, during this state of peace and quiet. So this is how we talk of the silence. It is a reconstruction of that which was a transcendent experiencing. There comes the stage when all sensory impressions completely stop. Your awareness gets abstracted, totally abstracted, out of the whole world of manifestation of any sort. All sensory impressions disappear. And when all sensory impressions disappear, but you are fully awake, not asleep, not unconscious, not in a coma, not in a trance, you awake to this new dimension of being and consciousness, to the state of the infinite, experienced by you yourself, the finite organism. This is the miracle, so to say, of transformation. What has happened is that your mode of awareness of this same world in which we live all through our lives has undergone a complete transformation. It has moved through all the limiting barriers of space, time, measurement, quantity, through all relativity. And you are actually in the state where the experiencing of the Absolute begins. And as you go through this state, this is the second great portal of death. through which you pass. You die, that is, you emerge out of the state in which the calm mind was freed from discursive thought. You emerge out of that into the state where infinity itself, transcendence itself, is now functioning through you. If you like to, if you use Christian terminology, the Son of Man is now the Son of God. One and the same. The Hindus expressed it as Pratyag Atma and Param Atma, the infinite, the ultimate, the total spirit which is within oneself, and the spirit which is transcendent God, if you like to use that term, are one and the same. Pratyag Atma, oneself, Paramatma, the Supreme Self. They are one and the same. Jesus said, I and the Father are one. Now, one may say, all this is very well, but just what happens? If you ask just what happens, then it means that you haven't begun to understand. This is nondescript. There are just certain things which can be said about it. Whilst you are in this state, the transcendent energies, the unknown transcendent energies, which work through the whole universe, are working through you unhindered. You yourself are totally unresisting to the divine influence, to the influence of this transcendent power. It works through you, transforming your total environment, as well as yourself. If and when one enters into these states because one has grown all those mental powers, released those mental powers which enable you to be the unresisting, transparent chalice through which these forces can work, then obviously that is just what will happen. You won't know it whilst it is happening. Afterwards, when you come back to ordinary sense perception and logical discursive thinking, talking, when in fact the silence is broken by the flow of words, then you will raise up mental constructs to try and convey that which is real experiencing of transcendence itself. But you are, in that state, the medium. You are the vehicle, the living vehicle of transcendence. And it is because this has been and is a reality that men have worshipped the teacher as incarnate God. Christianity does it, Hinduism does it, Buddhism does it without using the term God, for the very simple reason that logically, even logically, a creator God as conceived by man is a projection out of man's mind. So Buddhism prefers to leave aside the word God, but it has substituted other words. It has presented transcendence. I use the word transcendence constantly, because it is not so loaded as the older words. Buddhism presents it as the unborn, the unbecome, the unmade. Now look at those three words. Don't they represent transcendence? You know how when a child asks, "Who made me?" And of course, mama or papa, out of love for the child, says, "God made you." And the child gets more and more interested and solemn and finally demands to know, "Well, who made God?" And you, what can you say? "I don't know." All you can say is that God was from the beginning. There is no time involved there. There is only eternity and immortality. But tell an 8-year-old or a 9-year-old eternity and immortality, and perhaps in 5 minutes he'll go and play cricket, because he cannot enter that realm at all. What does immortality mean for him, or eternity? You see? This is the point. In this state, then, you experience this reality. And because your influence upon those around you is of a nature which completely surpasses the influence of any other type of man, scientist, artist, philosopher, whoever he may be, upon his environment, people worship the Holy One as God incarnate, transcendence incarnate. This is the living God, the meaning of the living God. Now, logically, intellectually, that which is realized through the particular individual, the particular being, is transposed to the totality itself. What is spoken of with respect to the microcosm is now spoken of with respect to the macrocosm. Hence, in the theologies of the world, you will find God is the creator of the world, of the whole world, not only of the individual manifestations that we are aware of. God is the creator of everything, including what we call evil. It's a strange thing to say. Consider this problem of the conflict of good and evil. Who makes the distinction between good and evil? I do. You do. What do we call evil? That which causes us pain, brings bad results, as we say. How do we experience pain? What do we mean by bad results? Through our sensation apparatus. But now, I may feel such sensations as painful, another person may find them quite pleasurable. What then is bad? What then is evil? Take the question away from the plane of physical experience to the plane of the mind. A person of a certain, a particular person may say, oh, but it is perfectly right and proper to live like this and behave like that. And another person may say, this is utterly evil, this is an utterly wicked way of living. So you see, this distinction between good and evil is a distinction which I myself make. The distinction between the pleasant and the unpleasant is the distinction that I make. Take one's own body. We take a healthy, strong young man, most attractive to look at, and we think, oh, how pleasant. And attractive features, good strong muscles, clear eyes, and so forth. That's all very true, very beautiful, very nice, very attractive. But what is inside here, in the intestines, for instance? But it is that same fellow who has both, making up his totality. In terms of the infinite, where discriminative consciousness no longer functions, but total consciousness only, everything is accepted. Everything is part of it. So you see, this good and evil is a relative matter. For us as human beings, we have our moral perceptions, and underlying them, we have this categorical imperative of absolute virtue, of divine virtue, animating us. That we have. The animals haven't got that. We make the distinctions. And within our limited context, our particular relative morality applies. But when, through the religious discipline, you have grown out of relative morality, what have you grown into? Don't think that you can cast away the relative laws of living the pure life, the good life. Can't cast them away. What has happened is that virtue at a relative level has now flowered into a transcendent state altogether. And in the flowering into a transcendent state, what you and I call evil and vice at our relative level has become purified and converted into the transcendent reality. You and I know the love-hate complex, the cruelty-kindness complex, the two together oscillating this way and that way. But when you live the pure life, then you're absolutely loving, absolutely wise. This is the difference. And in these deep states of consciousness, this transformation into a permanent realization of pure virtue comes into being. Then you don't react to the external stimulus because it causes you discomfort or pain. Because you don't like it. Because it is not what oneself would like the world or the other person to be. We understand everything, and in that understanding, which takes in everything, one's own psyche is infinitely resilient, capable of infinite absorption of whatever comes, and in that state, within our own being, the relative evil as well as the relative good, which is at a childish level, gets transmuted into the absolute good. This is what happens. So, what is the use of the religious life? You see? That towards which mankind is slowly and steadily moving, the urge and the power of nature, its evolutionary power, is behind us, pushing towards our fruition, and this unspeakable love and wisdom of transcendence is inviting us to that fulfillment. And it is these states, these deep states of awareness of your mystic or yogi or whoever he may be, it is in these states that this tremendous transformation takes place. And through the transformed being, benediction flows out onto the world in which we live. One goes on, enters into profounder states, having realized the infinity of what we call mind or consciousness, discriminative consciousness, and the infinity of the manifested world, space and all that is in space, one begins to see that all this is no thing. It is nothing in the sense of trying to evaluate it in relationship to the Absolute. The Absolute is beyond all valuations. In the Absolute, all limited valuations are subsumed. Nothing is destroyed, nothing is thrown away, because these valuations are necessary in order that growth may take place through man as man. And when man realizes this union with the totality, with the divine, with the transcendent, then those relative values no longer bind, and only the absolute values function. Then one realizes that this apparently solid world is one vast emptiness, one vast transparency, through which transcendent energy moves without let or hindrance. It is a transparency. In that sense, it is empty. What you and I experience through our senses and so forth, through our everyday experience as solid things and so forth, are merely this same fundamental no thing, this divine energy, which through self-constriction displays a thing, a separate thing, which you and I see. When this constriction completely vanishes, there is only this mysterious no thing. When one realizes that, actually experience, by actual experience in the deeps of consciousness, then I say of myself, I am nothing, which is the real fact. I am nothing. To use the Christian mystical phrase, I am reduced to my nothingness. In the Buddhist terminology, you've got it as entering the plane of nothing and abiding in it. Think, even intellectual, ordinary, limited intellectual thought can give us some glimpse of it. What can be the meaning of entering onto the plane of nothing, of no thing? You can't enter into no thing, into nothing. You can't enter into it. But it means that your awareness has become so transformed that the limitations produced by the functioning of our senses completely, you have gone completely past all that, and you realize you are aware of this transcendent energy, pure energy. So that this thing, this solid object here, for instance, is no longer a solid object in your awareness. It is there in terms of your physical sense experience. You are aware in physical sense terms experience in terms of limitation, of finitude. But its finitude vanishes in consciousness when you enter this silent state, this state which is utterly silent, utterly peaceful. Look at the actual physical universe, even with the senses. These mighty galaxies and suns and stars and whatnot, they are incredibly tiny specks in the vastness of the infinite. All the stuff of the universe, scientists calculated this in the early part of this century. If you took the actual stuff itself, the material stuff, it would go inside a little cup. Can you conceive it with the mind? And there is no reason to doubt what the scientists have been able to find out. It'll go into a little cup. The rest is emptiness. A vast emptiness. So you see the mystery which is transcendence. It functions in this manner. And it is for man so to grow that he can enter into these states as he pleases, when he pleases. There will always be restrictions to that. But by and large, as he pleases, when he pleases, and for as long a time as he pleases. It is on this matter that there are conflicting statements in the different religions. St. Teresa, for instance, says quite openly that it lasts only for a few seconds. The Hindus and the Buddhists say quite the contrary, that when you enter into the state of contemplative union, which we call meditation, samadhi, and so forth, you see, you can enter, and because the body has been trained, and because the mind is completely pacified, you can remain in that state for a long time. For as many as 7 days without moving. Now this is an extraordinary thing. You don't eat, you don't drink, you don't excrete, you don't sleep. You're fully awake. And it can last up to 7 days for a certainty. Then, the body being the body, one has to come back, let it move, it must eat, it must drink, it must sleep, and so forth. But these are facts attested by hard-headed, incredulous people from Europe who have witnessed this kind of thing. British Army officers, for instance, in India have observed this actually. That here is a fellow sitting there, and he stays there just like that. Now do realize, this is not a state of trance, a state where you have lost control of yourself. This is not a state of ecstasy. The word ecstasy has been used throughout all religious and mystical literature. Ecstasy is the wrong word. Ecstasy means being beside yourself, out of yourself. This is not an ecstasy. The whole process is an enstasy. It's a going inward. And you will see the real good sense of looking at it this way. A process of going inward, because if you stand outside yourself, you stand outside yourself as a measurable, limited entity. There is no infinity involved in it. But go inward in mind and consciousness. You will reach the point, the ultimate point. And a point has neither length, breadth, nor depth. It has no measurement, no measurability. This is the important part. There is that other meaning of infinity. Go outwards, as we say. And the boundlessness when you go outwards is the other infinity. The word infinity, mathematically, conceptually, has these two meanings. The infinity of the large, the infinity of the small. But when you go inwards, you enter the infinity of the small. That is why the religious literature of the world talks of the ultimate, the absolute, God, whichever word you like, as smaller than the small, greater than the great. And this is its mystery, its marvel. And this can be said simply because human beings in the ultimate state of contemplative union, of samadhi, realize these things. In finality, so to say, that is to say finality, meaning as far as a living human being can go, the phrase which the Buddha used is a very telling phrase. You touch nirvana with the body. Now one must not pictorialize this nirvana. If you do, that's the end. Take, in this context, the first meaning of nirvana. It means literally a blowing out. And of course, all our dear scholars through the decades have said, there's the end as promised by the Buddha. You're blown out. Meaning you're annihilated. Nothing of the sort. They have neither studied this deeply enough, nor have they practiced the disciplines. It's no good talking about things religious unless you have actually lived the life and realized for yourself something at least of what you're trying to convey. It is the blowing out, the extinction it is sometimes called, Nirodha, translated as extinction. Not Vinasha, which means destruction in the ordinary worldly sense, but this Nirodha, this fading out of the limited state into the infinite state, you see. It is the extinction of all greed, hate, delusion. Now, that means that the living organism, the living person, is so utterly purified, that this transcendent reality is present and functions through him. The Buddhists and the Hindus too, but to a lesser extent, prefer to use negative terminology. There is very great wisdom in this, because whatsoever can be positively stated is that which you see, touch, and so forth. And it is always limited. How do we talk of things transcendent? How do we sort of make some meaning out of it all for ourselves? By negating that which we know. Yajnavalkya in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, one of the greatest of the holy ones of the past. I'm sorry, I used a bad word, greatest, comparing. No comparisons where perfection is concerned. It's a grave mistake. One of the wonderful holy ones of the past. Speaking of the ultimate essence, the ultimate reality, he says, not this, not this, not this. It is not long, it is not short, it is not white, it is not black, it is not anything that you and I can talk of. Because whatsoever you and I can talk of is finite, particular. It is infinity spoilt, made bad, being far from the total reality, the absolute. You have to shut your eyes, stop your ears, and nestle in the bosom of God, of the infinite. Then you are truly a man. And you see what has happened then? God has realized Godhood, His own Godhood, through you, the perfected, unresisting one. Realized His Godhood as man come to perfection. Man who is His creation. Why do you think all the great teachings have talked of this supreme creative energy creating all these things? Why take the trouble to do it? It is a means of self-realization by the Supreme through the little selves that come into being. You see, understand this, and you understand this wonderful teaching about Jesus being God incarnate. The same applies to the other religions, but since you are born in a Christian tradition and know something, at least, if not a good deal, about it, it's very interesting to look into this. You look at the name of Jesus, the Hebrew name, Yahshua, Yod, He, Shein, Vav, He. There is the letter Shein in between. Yod, He, and Vav, He. But Yod, He, and Vav, He by itself is Yahweh. But Yahweh, the transcendent, in His transcendence, doesn't find ultimate fulfillment in terms of finite expression. Yahweh created the universe, all right. But He just remains Yahweh. This letter Shein, which joins the two aspects of Yod-He and Vav-He, means the actual ultimate concrete realization of whatever the characteristics of transcendent energy may be. It is the enfleshed transcendence. And it's that same idea which you find in the Upanishadic statements, the realizing of the Atma, making real, making concrete here and now, the becoming Brahman, as it is said. And of course, people rebel against this. They say, good heavens, what extraordinary conceit. This is, in saying Aham Brahmasmi, this is not the same as Lucifer aspiring to equality with the Lord. And Lucifer finds himself downstairs afterwards in consequence, in a warm place. You see? Aspiring equality means separating the wholeness. I am as good and as great as you, or I am going to be. What am I? A usurper? Am I not? And the wages of sin is death. You see the difference between the devotee. St. Teresa, for instance, says that she talks of the seventh mansions, and in this section, the seventh mansions in the interior castle, it is the mystical Christian mystical correspondent to these profounder states of consciousness which are mentioned by the Hindus and the Buddhists. It is the supreme ultimate realization of the Unio Mystica. You see? So, it is the actual enfleshment, the actual concrete realization of that which religion has spoken of. Now you see the significance of the silence and the meaning of the silence. When this is silent, when this enters upon and abides in the plane of nothing, or is reduced to its own nothingness, when this itself touches nirvana with the body, or the theist is completely at one with God, then the silence has come to full fruition and it speaks. There is a vibrating in tune with the pulse of life, in rhythm with the pulse of life itself. And this is the end point, as far as I can see, of the whole of the religious discipline and its fulfillment. Thank you.